The reading today is Hebrews 2 to Hebrews 3, verse 6. That can be found on page 1001 of your church Bibles. Hebrews, starting at chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard. While God also bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will. Now it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him, but we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he may taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation I will sing your praise. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, behold, I and the children of God has given me. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he may destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Therefore he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Therefore, holy brothers, you who share in a heavenly calling, consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him who appointed him, just as Moses was also faithful in all God's house. For Jesus has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses, as much more glory as the builder of a house has more honor than the house itself. For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all God's house as a servant to testify to the things that were being spoken, that were to be spoken later. But Christ is faithful over God's house as a son, and we are his house, if indeed we hold fast our confidence and our boasting in our hope.
Thanks for reading, Fiona. Let me introduce you to Priscilla. That's Priscilla. She's a cargo ship. She hit the rocks and ran aground on the coast of Britain last summer. No one was injured apart from Priscilla herself, who took a bit of damage to her hull. And because the government like to do reports into these things, they like to see what happened. They did a report. It came out this week. And anyway, the only reason it caught my attention was because last week we were talking about ships that go off course. So I read the report. What happened with this one was the officer in charge, he was sitting, you see the nice big comfy leather seat on the left-hand side? Looks good, doesn't it? He was sitting on the seat watching music videos on his mobile phone, and then he fell asleep at the steering wheel of 2,000 tons of metal. Anyway, as I say, there's this whole 45-page report. I won't bore you with the details. The conclusion of the government experts after all of their analysis is that people shouldn't watch music videos on their phones while they're driving big ships like Priscilla. Shrewd bit of analysis. I'm so glad we've got these experts, aren't you? Well, that officer, he didn't mean it to happen, clearly. Didn't notice it happening gradually. He just drifted. And we began to think last week about drift in the Christian life. Do you think it would be possible for you to drift away from Jesus? I had some great honest chats with some of you after last week's talk. It's a haunting idea, drift, isn't it? Because it's usually so subtle. And haunting too because of what Hebrews says about the Christians who first received this letter. They loved God. They were great servants of the saints, chapter 6. Chapter 10 says they endured public humiliation for Jesus' sake. They stood by suffering believers. And yet, chapter 2, verse 1, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. It's nautical language there on the positive side as well as on the negative. Pay attention was a term used for keeping a ship on track, what our friend navigating Priscilla failed to do. And it's the same root word, actually, in chapter 3, verse 6, right at the end of our reading. Hold fast. Same thing. The default is drift, and so we need to proactively pay attention if we're going to stay on track in the Christian life, which, let's be honest, is just not an easy thing to do. Tarsha was very honest. Thanks, Tarsha, for such an honest interview there. All kinds of reasons we can drift. We can get hard-hearted to the same old gospel. Sluggish in the basics of Bible reading, meeting together. We can be embarrassed about being the different one in that new group of friends that you've just formed this week. Tempted to fall back, to fall away. Not usually in a big dramatic moment of renouncing my faith. More often, drift, which leads to dangerous places. 2 verse 3. How shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? There's a serious warning there. Get ready for the warning next week. Chapter 3 to 4 unpack the warning. But today begins to unpack the positive side of sentence 3. Such a great salvation, greater than any rescue God's ever done, greater than what he did through Moses. Last week in chapter 1, our view of Jesus was expanded. If you're here, do you remember the balloon? Every clause, every sentence, magnifying him. Well, today that happens with salvation itself. Salvation magnified. It's an old-fashioned word, isn't it? Salvation, the Salvation Army. Evangelicals of an older generation used to use salvation language about someone becoming a Christian. Jimmy there got saved at the end of the meeting last night, they would say. Well, we'll begin to think about what this language means, but the point is hold fast to such a great salvation. Don't neglect it. And this is really God trying to recapture our attention, or maybe for the first time, if you've never heard this, trying to grab your attention with the sheer magnitude of all that he has done for us. And I feel weak as a preacher, you know, every week. I feel conscious that to get you to pay attention when there's so much on your mind, if you're new to London, it's exciting. But this is God's word, and so I have big hopes that by his Spirit, he will use the rest of our time together to grab our sense of what's important. To go back to our opening analogy, if you like, that he's trying to say, don't be distracted by music videos on that mobile phone when you're on the path to glory. So let's look at this great salvation, and this is the place where we'll be for most of the time. There's a handout there. Did you see inside? We like to put those for you just in case you want to take notes and help you to follow along. I've broken this down into three parts. First, our great problem. You'll only ever understand a great salvation when you understand the greatness of the problem you have been saved from. Maybe you noticed our blackboard at the back when you came in. This was from the lunchtime talk we did the other week for students on suffering. And in the morning, we got the students throughout that day to add their thoughts on why we suffer. Thank you if you contributed. Selfishness was one answer. Our own insecurities, another. We all want to do our own thing, someone wrote. A recurring theme there being that the human problem is the problem humans. And the tragedy is, see, we were designed for so much more. The Bible picture of what it means to be human is just very different from the view of modern science. The late Professor Stephen Hawking, a genius, who'd want to dare to disagree with him on most things, this is what he says. He said, the human race is just a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet orbiting around a very average star in the outer suburbs of one among 100 billion galaxies. We are so insignificant that I can't believe the whole universe exists for our benefit. Hebrews 2 verse 6 respectfully disagrees. Do you see it? What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. That's a quote from Psalm 8. Do you know Psalm 8? It's a great one. It's one of my favorites. It's a psalm for a clear, dark night when you get out of London and you realize there's these things up there that they call stars, which you've never noticed because you live in Zone 1. And as you look up there, aren't you just humbled as I consider the heavens, the work of your hand? What are little old us that God would be mindful of us? That's Psalm 8. Think of the Milky Way with its 500 billion stars. And then that Milky Way, one of more than 150 billion equivalent Milky Ways in the observable universe. In among all the vastness, why would God give us a second thought? Hawking must be right, surely. Verse 7 there again. What is man? Well, you made him, this is God, for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. What is humankind? Well, we were made to be crowned, to have honor, to be in control of a world that runs under us. And that's what it means, actually, to be made in God's image when you look back in Genesis. We were designed as deputy gods. Made for a little while lower than the angels, that's not negative. It just means we're not in heaven at the moment. But in this realm of the observable universe, we are as glorious as it gets. And so while we're Googling the statistics about the Milky Way, imagine the planets up there having a conversation among themselves. Have you Wikipedia'd the page about human beings? 7 billion of them. They're amazing. The world was designed to run brilliantly under our stewardship. And it is amazing, isn't it, what we are capable of? What we've achieved? The problem is that the end of verse 8, at present we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. We don't see the world operating the way it was supposed to under the good leadership of humankind. I'm afraid that's about the easiest part of the Christian gospel to persuade people of. And it's not just that we can't control the big things like the economy. We can't control the weeds in the back garden. Even our astroturf outside has started to have weeds grow up through it. Can you believe it? And we can't, let's be honest, even control ourselves. We see exploitation. We see natural disasters and global warming. We see death. which is our totally self-inflicted and deserved punishment. Because we didn't want to run the world under God. We wanted to run it instead of him. And ever since, we've been condemned to brokenness. See, it's not just the tragedy that God planned that the dog wouldn't bite and that the weeds wouldn't grow. The tragedy is we were born to rule and to live forever. Look at us now. Well, look at verse 15 and look at us now. All those who through fear of death were subject, it says, to lifelong slavery. Instead of ruling the earth, we've become the subjects, the slaves, to a day in the future when the planet that we're supposed to be running swallows us up back into the dust forever. Cheerful thought, isn't it? Maybe you think Hebrews writer, bit of a grumpy old man. Well, of course there are still blessings even in a damaged world. But everything's spoiled ultimately by the sin, death, chaos cycle. Our problems couldn't be any more global or pervasive or terminal. Well, thank the Lord for that little word, but, at the start of verse 9. Do you see it, verse 9? We don't yet see everything in subjection, but we see him. We see Jesus, our great hero. And Hebrews will go into loads of detail about precisely how Jesus helps us. The end of our passage is a trailer for some of those ideas. Verse 17, Jesus as priest. We'll get to what propitiation means. Actually, loads of wonderful gospel ideas all contained in this reading, you might have noticed. This chapter is mainly the broad brushstroke that paints a picture of the fact that Jesus is the one who saves the day. And I take it that won't be a surprise to anyone who was here last week, because if sin is the spoiler, we'll need to find someone who hates wickedness and loves righteousness. That's how he was described in chapter 1. Death is your problem? Well, here's one whose years have no end, chapter 1 said. You're in a broken world? Well, if only there was someone able to fold up this world like a worn-out garment and start again with a new one. Exactly how Jesus was described. No surprise at all, I think, that Jesus is the hero who can help. The shock is how he helps. One local poet from round here puts it this way: the maker of the stars and sea become a child on earth for me. God doesn't say humans are a bit rubbish at running the world. God should take back control. God becomes a human to fulfill our destiny. Psalm 8 becomes a prophecy fulfilled in Jesus. Did you see how verse 9 starts to make some of those connections? We see him for who a little while was made lower than the angels. He enters this earthly realm, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor, it says. Again, that was what we saw happening to him in chapter 1, him enthroned and in a place where God is putting all enemies in subjection under Jesus' feet. Yeah, the person described last week was glorious if you were here, but what was described was a man, a special son, a king for sure, but a human being. I don't know if you think about this very much, but God couldn't help us from up there. A bit like on Prison Break. Do you know that show? He had to actually, if you like, break in to the mess to break us out. He has to become one of us. And here's an illustration to help you get this. Sorry, it's a bit silly. And sorry, it's about football, if you don't like football. All you need to know to understand this is that Ronaldo, there he is still, we could have the debate, in the top two players in the world today. What's undisputed is that Scotland, this is the other thing you need to know, Scotland, the nation that I come from, are not very good at football, or to be honest, most other sports that we engage in. Imagine Ronaldo's heart goes out to the Scots. Being Portuguese and all, it's difficult for him to help. But he's serious. He decides to become Scottish. Gives up his Mediterranean diet, starts to eat haggis, dyes his hair ginger, moves to Scotland, plays for Scotland. McNaldo, we'll call him. Sounds like something you get at McDonald's, doesn't it? Well, that's just my little fantasy, unfortunately. Football's best becoming Scottish. God joining our tribe. That is the wonderful true story of the Bible. And it is one of the most beautiful features, I think, of the gospel story. No distant deity hearing our plight from afar and wishing us well from the comfort of the balcony. Meet the God of genuine solidarity. Verse 11. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. Footnote shows you that that means they are all of one. That is why, verse 11 goes on, he is not ashamed to call them brothers. Some people have genuinely embarrassing family members, don't they? Maybe you are the embarrassing one in your family. Sometimes we're ashamed of people in our church family. Sometimes we're ashamed of Jesus. How does Jesus feel about you and me? Do you know Kev at all? Jesus? Do I know Kev? Yeah, of course. My brother. Blows me away that the Lord of all would want to be associated in such a tight-knit manner. And that's not just nice words. It means really tangible things. Partly about the fact that he left the world of angels and his day job spinning planets. He entered the mess. Verse 14. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things. Verse 17. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect. Maybe we're so used to Jesus the man that we forget how shocking this is in the realm of religion. Flesh and blood speak of weakness. Flesh is when you fall and cut yourself. Blood is when you suffer. Flesh and blood are dirty and mortal. And this is one of the reasons that some other religions are so offended by the Bible. God can't become a human being. Scandal. Actually, he can't help us unless he does. His great deliverance is the third thing about this great salvation. And you can see that his death is his destiny all the way through. Verse 9. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death. Notice, because this is bigger even than just the glorious one became a man, crowned with glory because he died. Verse 10 that follows is even stronger on that. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation, get this, perfect through suffering. Not moral perfection, Jesus was already perfect in that sense before, but God's purposes for Jesus are not perfected without the way to the cross. Verse 14. Since, therefore, the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Do you fear death? It's like a shadow that looms over everything, isn't it? It can ruin any good conversation. Have you had a good day? Oh, well, one day you'll die. Are you good at what you do? Well, one day you'll be dead, and then you won't be good at what you do. It just kind of bursts all human pride and joy, ultimately, in the end. It's like a lifelong slavery that we're constantly in subjection to. Can I ask how you cope with that? Can anyone help you with that big problem? Well, our God becomes our brother and has tasted death for everyone. He keeps drinking deeply of death until there's no poison left in the devil's ugly cup. And there'll be loads more to say in Hebrews about the technicalities of things like priesthood, propitiation. Hebrews will elaborate mightily on the greatness of our salvation. The big point here is that, like Ronaldo in the illustration, only one from within the family can atone for the sins of the family. Only a member of the family can die the death that the family deserve. The author J.B. Phillips wrote an imaginary tale of a junior angel being shown around the universe by an older one. "Watch that one in particular," said the senior angel. "That's the visited planet." "Visited?" replied the junior. "Do you mean to say that our great glorious prince went down to that fifth-rate little ball? Stooped so low as to become one of those creeping, crawling creatures?" "I do. And I don't think he would like you calling them creeping, crawling creatures in that tone of voice. For strange as it may seem to us, he loves them. He went down to lift them up, to become like him." The little angel looked blank. Such a thought was almost beyond his comprehension. God joined our family to lift us up, to join his. Did you notice that aspect of the brotherly connection? This is not just solidarity. Verse 10, he's leading, bringing up many sons to glory. Verse 13, he makes us children of God. And 3, verse 1, calls us holy brothers and sisters. He makes us fit for the heavenly family. God's great heart's desire, his great project since Abraham onwards, has been forming a family, which means giving us an inheritance in the family. And wonderfully, it's about the slavery of death being broken. You know, this week is exactly 2 weeks we're remembering since my mum died. She passed away, I can't believe it's 2 years ago now. She was only 62 after a long battle with cancer. And, you know, she died without any fear of death. My mum, it was amazing to watch. She wasn't superhuman. She was always scared of things like cats and had other phobias. And I know that some people just don't have the chip in their head that makes them fear death, nothing to do with being a Christian. I know people with a strong faith who still fear the mechanics of dying. But my mum had no fear because she trusted the God who had become her brother. And it is a full reversal that's promised here. 2 verse 5 speaks of a world to come that will inherit. Salvation's so much bigger than something in your heart or your body or even just a new land for God's people. It's about global rebirth, where everything dances to Jesus' perfect tune. Remember why we're being told this. This is point 2 on the sheet, and don't worry, it's much shorter than point 1. Hebrews 2, verse 3. How shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? Don't neglect it. It's very realistic, that word neglect, isn't it? It's not about waking up one day and suddenly saying, "No more Bible for me." Just gradually drifting. And we want here to be a church family where we can be honest about the many, many ways that we wander into neglecting this stuff. You know, it's a fragile time for many of you. If you're new to London, that means working out your priorities. And actually, it's always difficult working out our priorities, whether we're going to prioritize these things. Life can crowd it out at every stage. We get bored. Or this just doesn't seem like the most important thing right now. You know, some of you might live for another 90 years if you keep eating the avocados for breakfast. Not fearing death so much, I guess, because it just doesn't feel very present. Well, consider Jesus. That's what 3 verse 1 is telling us to do. It's an exercise in Christian mindfulness that's required here. However and wherever you do it, proactively, regularly, fix your gaze on him. So when you're tempted to be ashamed of Jesus in that new friendship group or among that group of Christians at the Christian Union who don't seem like the coolest people at the university, consider Jesus, who wasn't ashamed of you, even though he'd plenty of reasons to be. When you face prejudice, even suffering, because of your connection to him, consider Jesus, who was made perfect through suffering. When it seems wearying going on in this life of faith, all this waiting for promises to be fulfilled, consider Jesus and the lengths he has gone to win your inheritance in that new world. When whatever is the equivalent of the music videos on the mobile phone are more interesting, whether that's career or sport, the relationship that consumes you, when you feel the brokenness of the world, and on the days when you just wonder, does anybody out there notice or care? Consider your God, who became your brother, to help you with your big sin and death problem. And ask yourself, who in the big scheme of things is offering you more, or helping you more, or on your side more than him? Is anyone else writing you into a bigger story? Or giving your heart more of a reason to sing? How shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? Such a great salvation. Amen.